On behalf of the Brown Daily Herald, I welcome all of you to Sales Hall. Tonight we present two different viewpoints on the American Negro and his future. Originally, Mr. Herbert Wright of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was to have shared this platform with Minister Malcolm X of the Black Muslims. However, at 4 o'clock this afternoon, as Mr. Wright, who had just returned from a speaking tour on the West Coast for this program, was en route to the airport, he was informed by an associate that the NAACP had recently passed a rule prohibiting its spokesman from debating with Malcolm X or any other member of the Black Muslims. Mr. Wright is sending us a statement. It was supposed to be here now. I don't know where it is, concerning his inability to attend. In lieu of the statement, I will read what he said to me over the phone. And I quote, "Because of derogatory statements made by Malcolm X about the NAACP on previous occasions, at a recent meeting of the National Board of the NAACP, a policy was stated that members of the NAACP would not be permitted to debate against Malcolm X or any other member of the Black Muslim movement. The conclusion reached was that the main effect of joining a member of the Black Muslims on the podium was to dignify them. This policy was unknown to me when I returned from Los Angeles this morning, and I deeply regret inconveniencing you." That's the end of the quote. I'm sorry the full statement isn't here, but I guess that's that. In light of Mr. Wright's withdrawal, Mr. Ralph Allen of the Rhode Island Commission Against Discrimination, who was originally scheduled to serve as moderator, has very kindly consented to present from this platform tonight the integrationist viewpoint. I beg you to bear in mind his kindness in accepting this difficult change in roles. And at this time, as a spokesman for the Herald, I would like to extend my deepest gratitude to him for bearing with us. To replace Mr. Allen as moderator, Dean Robert Schultz of Brown University has agreed on approximately 15-minute notice to serve. Mr. Schultz, whose friendship for the Herald is legendary, needs no introduction to many of you. I would now like to turn this program over to Ms. Catherine Pierce, Pembroke 64, a member of the Brown Daily Herald staff, who has more than a passing interest in the problems to be discussed tonight. Thank you very much.
One of the greatest opportunities afforded by a university such as Brown is one relevant to the expression of varying opinion. As members of this academic community, both students and faculty are constantly in contact with new ideas, new points of view, opinions derived from reconsideration of old ideas. Some of these thoughts are practical, rational, or relevant. Others are unacceptable to the rational or sensitive mind, and are practical only as they serve to excite further thought along the same lines, but with a different premise in mind or a different end in view. Tonight we are to hear a speaker who represents ideas on the solution of racial problems, which may be new to you. The ideas may be new, the problem, however, should not be. Perhaps it might be feasible to remind you that we are not divorced from the actualities of racial strife simply because we live in the North. If nothing else, tonight's program should remind you of your individual responsibility in the solution of these problems. Our second speaker may be able to show you the importance of your active participation in the struggle for Negro equality. We are indeed fortunate in the persons who have consented to be here tonight. One of the speakers is a foremost representative of a Negro sect which has been formed partly as the result of lack of effective action in the area of racial problems. If his ideas are acceptable to you, you may anticipate a brilliant speech in defense of your beliefs. If, however, you do not find that you can accept his ideas, his speech should challenge you to do some thinking about your own position, its appeal, and more important, your personal contributions toward making it a real and realizable solution. Malcolm X is representing the Black Muslims here tonight, as he has done in colleges across the country. He is the minister of the Black Muslim Temple in Harlem, and is known for his brilliant speeches, his debating skills, and his position of leadership in the movement. He became a Black Muslim in 1947 after many years of concern for racial problems in the United States. He was born the son of a minister in Omaha, Nebraska, and one of 11 children. He lived in Omaha and in Lansing, Michigan, where he became acutely aware of the Negro's position in American life before he moved to New York City. He has been given the title of Minister Malcolm X Shabazz, which is a particularly significant one. The Black Muslims are a group which has been the center of some controversy of late. They have been called, rightly or wrongly, an extremist group with radical answers to racial problems. They acknowledge certain ties with the Negroes of Africa and are not satisfied with the status of the Negro in America. There has been some interest in their claims of identification with the Islam of the East, and most of all, they are associated with the advocation of segregation. For those of us who feel that the Negro is an integral part of our culture and who advocate integration because we believe in the equality of all men, the Black Muslims are an indication of the fact that we have not done enough acting to make our position acceptable to the Negro dissatisfied with his present situation. The Black Muslims may be said to represent the younger Negroes of America who are tired of waiting for the integration, still far from being realized nearly 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Our second speaker tonight will be Mr. Ralph A. Allen, the present field supervisor of the Rhode Island Commission Against Discrimination. He is a graduate of Xavier University in New Orleans and has done graduate work at the University of Vermont, Simmons, the University of San Francisco, and Boston University. He is now engaged in study at Brown. He is the former director of special projects at the Rhode Island Urban League. He is a member of the NAACP and has lived in Providence for 7 years. He has for some time been active in civil and community affairs and very much aware of the problems of human relations. It is valuable that he is here tonight to represent as a very informed and active person integration. The order of the program will be as follows. Malcolm X will speak first and will be followed by Mr. Allen. Each will limit his speech to 50 minutes. After the speeches, there will be a question and answer period at which Dean Schultz will act as moderator and conduct the session. I now turn the platform over to Minister Malcolm X Shabazz.
Mr. Moderator and Ms. Pierce, and to the Brown Daily Herald, ladies and gentlemen, and brothers and sisters, that takes in everybody. Because of the very serious race problem which involves 20 million of our people here in America, the so-called Negroes, a serious problem that is causing Uncle Sam to be laughed at and embarrassed all over the earth, a serious problem which every effort has been made to solve but has yet gone unsolved. We thank Allah for this opportunity to explain to you here at Brown University this evening the solution which God has given to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I would like to point out, though, in answer to one of the opening statements that I didn't know would be made until it was made from the NAACP, I would like to go on record as stating that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad nor any of his followers have ever made any statement against the NAACP other than in reply to statements made by them. And we are sorry that they can't hold up under our burden like we hold up under theirs. We want to explain what Mr. Muhammad teaches, what are his aims, and what is his program. And we hope that this firsthand explanation will eliminate much of the present misunderstanding that now exists about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Muslims who follow him. First, we wish to thank the Brown Daily Herald and the students who have invited us here to the campus to speak to you and to explain firsthand who we are, what we teach, what we carry into practice, and what we want, and why. Since so much controversy is raging here in America today about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his fast-growing followers, It is only fair that we be allowed to speak for ourselves. And it is for this reason only that we accept the invitations to speak at the various campuses in the colleges and universities across the country. I myself have just returned from San Francisco, where I had been invited to lecture at the University of California by the student chapter of the campus NAACP. But after traveling 3,000 miles to honor their invitation, the invitation of these open-minded students, I was surprised to learn that their less open-minded faculty heads had slammed the door in my face. And now I know how Eisenhower felt after being invited to Japan and traveling so far to honor the invitation only to have the door slammed in his face. Only in his case, it was the young generation in Asia rebelling against the outdated ideas and practices of the old generation. And here it is the old generation rebelling against the open-minded, progressive ideas of the young generation. But as it turned out, the students of University of California simply rented a hall of equal size off campus, and we honored their invitation anyway. We are living in a world today of great changes. Those who can conform to the changes have a bright future. But those who try to build dikes and dams to stem these changing tides will only be drowned in a flood of their own making. We must learn to face facts, especially the facts of these changing times. This is the era, an era of change. Doors that were once closed to some of us are now opening, and doors that were once open to others are now closing. Whereas in the past, the opening and closing of doors was entirely in the hands of the white man, the colonial powers of Europe, or their rich brother, Uncle Sam, here in America, today, Almighty God, the one who has power over all things, is slowly but surely switching the power back into the hands of those who yesterday were under the power of others. Those who still think they have power to close doors today, tomorrow will find the very same doors closed to them, and the next day the doors to the entire dark world, because God himself is now standing at the door. In fact, he is in the door. I'd rather say he's the doorman. I am thankful to Allah for those of you who are here this evening, because to me it shows that you have an open mind. And I don't think you came here for me to convert you into being a Muslim, nor do I think that you think I came here for you to convert me back to being a Christian. When Eisenhower and Khrushchev sat down and talked to each other, Ike wasn't trying to make Khrushchev a capitalist, nor was Khrushchev trying to make Eisenhower a communist. They weren't there to convert each other, but their intelligence enabled them to recognize the times, the conditions, and the importance of each other's position. And it was the respect for each other's position that made them, though they had different views, take the time to sit down and try and understand each other and come to a mutual agreement, which was the only formula that would bring about peace. So they talked. And we feel that it is the same with you this evening. You're not here for conversion, but you want firsthand information and understanding about the Muslims and why we teach as we do. This is intelligent. When I read the Providence Evening Bulletin last night and saw where there was a great deal of concern or confusion over our appearance here at Brown University, it was not surprising, because we've been running into these things on an increasing scale. In the past, it has been possible for Negro leaders, so-called Negro leaders, to stand up on the campus or different forums and make statements about the Muslims with no one there to explain the Muslim side or challenge what these so-called Negro leaders were saying. And it has only been since the followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad have launched into an effort to stand on the same platform with these other so-called Negro spokesmen that they have begun to think better of standing on the same platform with us. And I think, two, whenever, as the paper said, that a Muslim can't come forth and explain his views other than in what they call a form fashion, but at the same time, you have NAACP spokesmen, CORE spokesmen, Urban League spokesmen, that can go in any church, in any college, or in any alley and stand up and say whatever they want, voice any opinions or expressions, whether there's someone there to take the other side or not. And it doesn't show intelligence on their part to want to deprive us of the right that up until now they have exercised as an exclusive right of their own. By doing this, they have perpetuated a one-sided picture for the integrationists and made the entire American public think that the black masses want integration or socializing with the white man. And by those black people in America who don't want integration not being given the opportunity to stand up and say what they want, the integrationists have actually presented a one-sided figure. And today, because the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is the most outspoken opponent of integration, even more so than the whites in Mississippi and Alabama, the people, the so-called Negroes who are advocating integration, think that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is a worse threat or enemy to them than the Mississippians and the Alabamans and the Georgians. And so they have been spreading rumors that actually misrepresent us, that I would like to take the time to straighten out this evening. To show you why it's wrong to be misinformed, a couple of weeks ago, the California State Court, Supreme Court, reached a decision that the men in prison who were trying to practice the religion of Islam would not be permitted to do so. Why? Because the Supreme Court reached the decision that these men actually are not involved in a bona fide religion. Now, I'm inclined to believe that these judges reached that decision not through factual evidence by studying what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches, but rather by reading what is written in the newspapers. Because they reached this decision, and therefore they outlawed or banned the Holy Quran, or the Bible of the Muslim world, from entering into the prisons. And they also outlawed the right of these men to practice the religion of Islam. Now, this was a decision reached by the California Supreme Court. On the other hand, the educators in the state of California would not allow us to speak on the University of California campus because they said we were a religion. Now, this is confusing. Whenever you find the judges, whom I think represent the most intelligent persons in the Western society, and the educators, who I imagine they do represent intelligent persons also, whenever the educators reach the conclusion that we are a religion, and the judges reach a conclusion that we are not a religion, then you can sympathize with us if we appear to be a bit confused. And besides, we do know that intelligence is supposed to enable one to exercise mental flexibility. But when we find these judges and the educators coming to such contrasting conclusions, I'm sure also you will agree with me that that's trying to force one to stretch one's mental flexibility a bit too far. That's expecting intelligence to go too far. So the question today is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad a bona fide religious leader, and are his followers a bona fide religious group? And this is a question that America has got to come face to face with. Is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad a bona fide religious leader, and are his followers a bona fide religious group? Now, if he is a bona fide religious leader, then whenever you try and oppose him, you are actually going against that which the Constitution claims that it guarantees. But the better question is, if you ask us, are we a bona fide religion, and is he a bona fide religious leader, I should ask you the question, in whose eyes? In the white man's eyes, or in God's eye? Who is to judge whether or not we are a bona fide religious group? Is it left up to you, or is it left up to God? And I repeat, are you to be the judge, or is God to be the judge? 100 years has passed by since the Emancipation Proclamation. The politicians have promised us false promises. They have lied to us. They have tricked us. And today we recognize their words as political subterfuge. Therefore, we reject politics, we reject the politicians, and we reject the political solutions. And because of this, we are turning back to our God, the God of our forefathers, and the religion of our forefathers, under the guidance and the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And before you can determine whether or not we are a religious group, and I strike this issue because it's very important, before you can reach the decision or come to the conclusion as to whether or not we are a religious group, you have to know something about our religion. And I would like to take 5 minutes to explain to you what it is. As a Muslim, we believe in Allah. Those of you who are Christians, you call him Lord, Jesus, or maybe something else. The Jewish people call him Jehovah or Elohim. But all of you are referring to a supreme being. But those of us who are Muslims refer to our God, the Creator, the supreme being, as Allah. And we believe that he is one God, and that this one God is the same God who was responsible for the messages delivered or taught by every prophet who walked on this earth, from Abraham, Noah, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, whom we recognize as the last of the prophets. And we are taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad that all of these prophets had the same religion, and that the name of that religion was Islam, and that Islam in the Arabic tongue only means one who has submitted himself completely to the will of Allah, and who is in complete obedience to the will of Allah, and is trying to live a righteous life or a life of righteousness, and who is seeking peace, or who has entered into peace with the God of peace. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that when one accepts Allah as God and Islam as his religion, he refers to himself as a Muslim, which here in the Western world is commonly misspelled and mispronounced Muslim. And some of the press, and it surprises me because we take them to be more intelligent, have formed the habit of referring to us as Muslims and our brothers abroad as Muslims, and then saying, these aren't Muslims, rather, these are Muslims, not Muslims. But those of you who are familiar with the Arabic language are well aware that a Muslim is a Muslim and a Muslim is a Muslim. And I think that if when you learn this, you should go and tell the press so that they won't make the mistake of misrepresenting your intelligence to the entire world. Because when people in what they call the Muslim world read what they write and their accusation that we're not Muslims, but we're Muslims, they only end up laughing at you. A Muslim is one who has submitted himself to God. A Muslim is one who obeys God. A Muslim is one who is seeking to lead and live a righteous life. Or a Muslim is one who is peaceful because he is adhering to the or submitting to the will of the God of peace. And this is what we're taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We're taught as Muslims never to be the aggressor, never look for trouble, always seek peace. But at the same time, we're not taught to turn the other cheek when we're attacked. And if we defend ourselves when we're attacked, and that's not religion, then I don't want anybody's religion. If you didn't expect Uncle Sam to turn the other cheek when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, then you shouldn't expect the black people here in America, who have been bombed by the abuses and mistreatment of the whites here for 400 years, to turn the other cheek today. There are 725 million people in Africa and Asia whose religion is Islam, whose God is Allah, and who believe in all of the prophets the same as we. There are 725 million people in Africa and Asia, that strategic area today which Uncle Sam is trying to make friends, all of them turn 5 times a day eastward toward Mecca and give praise to Allah by saying, La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, which to the Muslim means, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. And when you deprive a black man in America of the right to turn toward Mecca and give praise to Allah, you are depriving the rights, you are interfering with the rights of 725 million more non-white people who predominate in Africa and Asia. And I thank you for the opportunity to explain this to you, and you should thank me for explaining it to you, because a misunderstanding of this will cause you to make moves that will cause Uncle Sam some of the worst embarrassment that he has ever encountered since America has been America. And you should not be surprised either that so many black people in America are turning toward the religion of Islam, because Dr. Billy Graham, a respected Christian gentleman, upon his return from Africa last year, pointed out that the black people of Africa are turning toward the religion of Islam away from the religion of Christianity at a ratio of 11 to 1. And when you see these noted theologians come back and tell you that the black people in Africa, the masses, are turning away from Christianity toward the religion of Islam at a ratio of 11 to 1, and Bishop Pike, another noted theologian, Christian, also in an article in the Look magazine in December, pointed out that the Africans are turning away from Christianity toward the religion of Islam at a ratio of 5 to 1. Now, they differ a bit on the figures, but both of them agree on the facts that the black people of Africa are turning away from what they call colonialism, oppression, exploitation, and Christianity. If Islam is sweeping Africa, as again I say, it shouldn't surprise you that it's also sweeping through America, through the 20 million so-called Negroes. But here in America, our religious leader and teacher and guide is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He's not a prophet, as the newspapers try and depict him. We don't call him a prophet, nor does he call himself a prophet. Muhammad was the last prophet. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us you don't need any more prophets, because prophets predict the future, and he's not telling you something that's coming 100 years from now. He's here to warn those of us who follow him what is right around the corner. And the message that he is the messenger, and the message that he has is a message of truth, enlightenment, unity, and salvation to America's 20 million black people, whom you will agree have been the most unenlightened and divided or disunited people that this earth has ever known. And I would like to point out, too, another error that is made, and it's important that you understand. They say that we are not Muslims, but this is the Holy Quran. In English, you call it the Quran, and because we don't call it Quran and we ask for the Quran, you think we're asking for a different book. And it's just like when you call the people whose religion is Islam a Muslim, and they come along and won't accept that term and say, "I'm a Muslim," because they don't pronounce it like you. Your pride makes you reach the conclusion that they're not what they claim to be. But this is the Quran. This book is the Bible of 725 million people in the non-white world, which I say non-white, predominantly in Africa and Asia. But when men in prison ask for a special version, it isn't that they're asking for a special Quran or a different Quran, but the Quran originally was written in Arabic, and the Arabs, knowing the ambiguous nature of the English language, refused to translate the Holy Quran from Arabic into English, and therefore the translations have usually been done by Pakistani Muslims, foremost of which have been Muhammad Ali and Yusuf Ali. So a Muslim who does not speak Arabic and can only speak English will only accept the translation of another Muslim. And to our knowledge up to date, the only Muslims who have translated this book into English have been Pakistani Muslims, Muhammad Ali and Yusuf Ali. And because men in prison have specified that they want a certain Quran, the wardens and your state officials, through lack of understanding, have deprived them of this book. And in so doing, I am free to say you actually alienate from you the sympathy and the affection and the regard of 725 million people who also follow the same book. I like to explain that to you so you won't continue to make this mistake. Thirdly, there are 100,000 Muslims in America who were born in the Muslim world, who have come here, or who were born here of Muslim parents. And although Islam, by nature, is a propagating religion, these 100,000 Muslims combined who were born abroad and who are here have not been successful in converting 1,000 Americans to the religion of Islam. Now, mind you, Islam is a converting religion. But despite its converting nature, The 100,000 foreign-born Muslims combined have not been successful in converting 1,000 Americans to the religion of Islam. But the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who was born here in Georgia, has hundreds of thousands of ex-slaves, so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, turning five times a day eastward toward Mecca, saying, Ashhadu alla ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadur Rasulullah, which again I repeat means, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. And those of you who are familiar with religion and the powerful force that it is in the East, surely you must realize that when you stop a black man in America from turning eastward and bearing witness to his God, you are doing more to harm the relationship that America has with countries abroad, primarily in Africa and Asia, than anything else you could do. So I'm here tonight to clarify that so the mistake won't continue to be made. Just as all of the Muslims there do, we practice the Muslim prayers, we practice charity, we practice fasting, and we practice the pilgrimage, which many of you perhaps know the Honorable Elijah Muhammad made to Mecca and Medina last year. And since there is so much effort made to try and depict the Muslims in America as other than a religious group, on the Mike Wallace television show last year, the criteria that they used was that the Muslims who follow Mr. Muhammad can't go to Mecca. Those of you who were in New York at that time and saw the program The Hate That Hate Produced, the controversy was they thought they were settling it by saying that the Muslims can't go to Mecca, so they're not real Muslims. And what made them say that was I was in Arabia at that particular time, and because I didn't go any farther than Jeddah, they were whooping and hollering in glee and using that as an example to prove that we're not really Muslims. If you check the film, you'll see. Now, when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad went to Mecca with his two sons, still they have to use something else now to try and prove that they're not recognized by the Muslims abroad, because in reality what they're trying to prove is that we are not a religious group, so then they can be justified in their attacks against us. But when you make the only way you can make the Honorable Elijah Muhammad not be a messenger of God and a man of God and his followers a religious group, you would have to take the son right out of the universe. And I would like to point out, and I'm going fast because I have so many minutes, and please let me know when I have 10 minutes more. There are 20 million so-called Negroes here in America, 20 million ex-slaves, 20 million second-class citizens. No matter what other classification you try and put on them, you can't deny that we are ex-slaves. You can't deny that we are second-class citizens. And the fact that we're a second-class citizen means someone has done us an injustice and deprived us of that which is ours by right. And the fact that we are ex-slaves again means someone has committed a crime by enslaving a fellow human being. Now, these 20 million today are uniting behind the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the religious teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I repeat, turning back toward the God and the religion of our forefathers. Why? Because the masses of black people in America feel that the white man's Christian church has failed to accept us as equals. His Christian religion has failed to clean up our morals. White Christians have refused to accept us as human beings, much less as citizens. And the white man's Christian government of America has failed to give us freedom, justice, equality, protection, and also citizenship. And just as in the days of Moses and the Hebrews when they were in bondage under a wicked slave master named Pharaoh, and Moses had to come along and not integrate the ex-slave with the slave master, but rather he told the slave master, let my people go, which was separation, and then he had to lead them to a land of their own flowing with milk and honey where they could serve their own God and their own religion. Today, likewise, the black masses are turning away from the Christian church of our slave master and turning back toward the religion of our God and toward the God who is the God of our forefathers. And in making this turn, in turning back this religion of our forefathers and belief in the God of our forefathers enables us to undergo an immediate reformation, moral reformation. The followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has stopped his followers from indulging in alcohol, dope, reefers, and tobacco. No follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad partakes of any alcoholic beverage, narcotic, reefers, or tobacco, which is prevalent in the Negro communities across the country. even right here in the city of Providence. The followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad do not steal, do not gamble, and do not lie. He has reformed us of these things, and we used to do all of them abundantly. I myself was one of the foremost practicers or doers of everything that I've mentioned here so far, and the teachings, telling you the truth, and the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad stopped me from doing these things overnight. And it has also stopped the rest of our people who are following him. He makes us aware of the importance of cleanliness. Every follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad must take a hot bath once every 24 hours. And when we were Christians, we took one every Saturday night, and we were lucky if we made it then. All praise is due to Allah. Likewise, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has eliminated from us laziness. We used to stand on the corner all day long, not doing anything for ourselves. But today, you never find the followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad standing lazily on the corner. We are taught that we must work, and we must provide for our family, and we must provide for our children, so that we can be better members of whatever community that we live in. Now, if that's hate, the Negro community needs to be taught more of it. He has eliminated from his followers fornication, adultery, and indecency, and this is something else that has run rampant in the Negro communities. He teaches the men to respect our women, elevate our women, and protect our women. And you may say, well, why do we specify our women? You don't have to teach Negro men to respect white women. No one can tip their hat faster or shine their teeth whiter at a white woman than the so-called Negro man. And I'm not standing here proudly and telling you that, but the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that it's time for the black man to respect his own woman for a change, elevate his own woman for a change, and protect his own woman for a change. And as Muslims, we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad feel that it is time that the black woman had some of the respect that the white woman has been receiving from black men for the past years. Also, he has eliminated juvenile delinquency completely from among his followers. And he has done this by making the black man proud of what he is. The parents are proud of what they are. They try and live up to it. The children see the parents respecting each other, showing affection for each other. So automatically, that makes our children grow up with affection for us and respect for us. And it eliminates juvenile delinquency. Also, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has been most successful in rehabilitating criminals. He has been so successful in rehabilitating criminals that the propaganda is put out that all of his followers are convicts, and that's far from the truth. I myself heard Islam in prison, which I'm not ashamed. I'm glad I went there in order to hear what changed me. I don't think I could have heard it had I stayed out in the street leading the life that I led as a Christian. So instead of the penologists giving the Honorable Elijah Muhammad credit for reforming and rehabilitating criminals, they are attacking him and trying to eliminate his teaching from spreading behind prison bars. And these wardens admit that after the men accept Islam and follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, they make better inmates than they were previously. And I would point out that it is not that his followers are all from prison. If you take salt, if you take bread and put salt under a magnifying glass or a microscope, you can easily fool someone and make them think that bread is salt. But salt is only one of the minor ingredients in the whole product. And this is the same thing that they do with the Muslims here in America. They magnify the fact that some of the Muslims come out of prison and try and give the public the impression that all we are is a bunch of ex-convicts and thugs and things of that sort. And one of the first ones to make that accusation was Attorney Thurgood Marshall, one of the foremost representatives of the NAACP. Now, if that's talking about the NAACP, I'm sorry. Also, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has not only rehabilitated the men in prison, but he is eliminating crime from the Negro neighborhood. No neighborhood in America, across the nation, has more police in it or is more heavily patrolled than the Negro, so-called Negro community. But despite the fact that there are more police officers patrolling the Negro, so-called Negro community than any other section of the city, still the most crime is in the Negro community. The most dope is in the Negro community. The most drunkenness is in the Negro community. So since it's so heavily patrolled, it shows that the police are not able to stop the crime, and or else they're in cahoots with the crime, one of the two, and therefore they should give Mr. Muhammad credit for doing a job in the prison that the penologist can't do, and doing a job of crime prevention in the Negro community that the police themselves admit that they can't do. And all of this is done, again I say, by instilling within our people race, pride, dignity, which and this is done by giving us a knowledge of self. So many of you may say, well, if we are really religious, why do we omit white people from our meetings? And are we anti-white? No, we're not anti-white. But we don't have time for the white man. The white man is on top already. The white man is the boss already. The white man has economic security already. He has first-class citizenship already. So you're wasting your time talking to the white man. We are working on our people. First things first, we look upon the so-called Negro in America as a sick man. When a man, you may say, well, what do I mean sick? If a man has forgotten his name, he's a sick man. They call that amnesia. And if you go to the so-called Negro here in America and ask him his name, he doesn't know it. If a Chinese person came through that door and I asked him his name and he said his name was Patrick Murphy, you'd know he forgot his own name and has picked up an alias somewhere. So, if a yellow man looks ridiculous wearing an Irish name, which is a white man's name, how much more absurd does a black man look wearing a white man's name? So we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, when we see so-called Negroes named Murphy and O'Toole and Johnson and Smith and Powell and Wright and Wilkins, which are all English and Irish names, we think that they look just as much out of place as a group of Chinese would look wearing those same names. And they wear these names because they don't know their own name. They have lost their identity, their own identity. So this is amnesia. And by not knowing themselves, when a man doesn't know himself, he doesn't know what belongs to him. He could be the richest man on this earth, but by having lost his identity, he'll walk around like a pauper. So here we have 20 million black people in America who are wearing the names of their former slave master, as we've been taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And by suffering a form of amnesia, they don't have a name of their own, so they've taken your name. They don't know their own language, so they've taken your language. They don't have a history of their own, so they let you tell them what their history is. And that, in essence, is that you found them in the jungle someplace with a spear chasing white people in a cannibalistic way to try and give the impression that white meat is the only good meat to eat. So we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad classify this as an amnesia or a form of mental sickness. And he teaches us also that the black people of America are sick spiritually. Whenever you have, if you go into China and find a Chinese who has adopted Christianity, because he still has a Chinese heart and a Chinese brain and Chinese concepts, whatever he sees through Chinese eyes. So though he accepts Christianity, if you ask the Chinaman to paint a picture of Jesus, he'll come out looking oriental like a Chinaman. Same way with an Eskimo. Put an Eskimo in the same position, and he will depict his Lord or Savior like an Eskimo. Because by nature, a person is forced to see that which he admires in his own eyes, or vice versa. Now then, you come here to the American white man and ask him for his conception of Jesus or his God, and he will always depict him as a white man, just like himself. But you go to the Negro in America and ask him for his conception of Jesus, and he'll show you a Jesus with a blonde hair and a blue eyes and white skin. Everyone can see their Savior through their own eyesight except the so-called Negro. Everyone has their own God except the so-called Negro. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that this is a form of mental sickness or spiritual sickness, and also we suffer from moral sickness. When you go into the Negro community, you find drunkenness running rampant, dope addiction running rampant. Also, as the decision down in Louisiana cutting off the aid to dependent mothers was made a few months ago, this affected Negro women more than anyone else, which meant that almost 80% of the unwed mothers in the state of Louisiana were our women, our own women. And this is immorality.
This shows that we suffer from a moral sickness. We're not able to protect our women nor see that they get the proper respect. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad says we also suffer a social sickness. We're not segregated. We're quarantined. We're treated like we have social leprosy. There's not a black man in America who has reached the age of 21 who hasn't gone somewhere around whites. It doesn't make any difference whether it's in Providence or Mississippi. There is not a black man or woman in America who has intelligence, who hasn't gone somewhere and around whites and felt like he was a social leper. You can walk in a white church, and though they have the doors wide open, the atmosphere there when they see you is so chilly, you think you have, you're not in heaven, not in hell, because it's not supposed to be cold in there. So also, we're economically sick. Economically sick, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad points out that the black man in America has an earning power of $20 billion a year, and despite the fact that we have this, we have done nothing for ourselves. Canada, as a nation, does not spend $20 billion a year, nor earn $20 billion a year. But the 20 million black people in America have a purchasing power or earning power of $20 billion a year. Now, yet Canada has built highways for Canadians, factories for Canadians, schools for Canadians, making jobs for Canadians, and are feeding Canadians. But the black people of America, with $20 billion at their disposal, have not so much as built a path through an alley with their name on it, much less a highway, a street, or a factory that will provide jobs for black people. And so the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that we suffer an economic sickness along with this social sickness, mental sickness, and spiritual sickness. And last but not least, he teaches us that we suffer from a political sickness. Whenever you find people who have fought for America as the black people have, and who have served America as the black people have, and yet they come here and are relegated to the role of second-class citizenship, they're politically sick. When you find somebody whom they claim the Emancipation Proclamation was to have freed 100 years ago, and still today, after fighting and dying in Korea, and fighting and dying in the South Pacific, the same as you, and fighting and dying in Germany, the same as you, they come back home and are still having to beg for first-class citizenship or rights, then we have to reach the conclusion that these people are yet politically sick. When a person is suffering from all these ailments, mental sickness, spiritual sickness, moral sickness, social sickness, economic sickness, and political sickness, why, that combination will kill anybody. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad says that this has made the 20 million black people here in America just like a dead people. Dead economically, dead mentally, dead spiritually, morally, and otherwise. And integration will not bring a man back from the grave. Integration will not relieve a man of mental sickness, nor will integration relieve a man of social sickness. When a man is sick, the only way you're going to get those who are not sick to accept him into their society is first cure that man of his sickness. And we feel that the white man does not discriminate against us because we're black, because people can come here from Africa as black as night and go anywhere they want. But you have black people or so-called Negroes, some of whom are almost as light as the white man, and the white man will tell you that he doesn't want them around him. So we don't feel that the attitude of the white man toward the Negro in America is based on skin coloration. We think that the white man instinctively and subconsciously realizes that these people called Negroes are suffering from a form of sickness, which he himself is responsible for. Your people are the cause. I'm just telling you about the condition right now. Get to the cause later. The white man feels that it would be impossible to accept those people into his society until they first have been cured of what ails them. Now, most of the other so-called Negro organizations concentrate on trying to change the white man's mind and force the white man to accept the black man or the so-called Negro. But we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are not trying to change the white man's mind nor force the white man to accept us into his community. The teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are designed to change the black man. They're designed to correct the condition of the black man. They're designed to make the black man see himself through new eyes and in a different light, to get more confidence in himself and then stand up on his own two feet and do something for himself. And I think that this is very important because The policy of the Muslims does not create a race problem. It corrects a race problem. The only time you have a race problem is when two races are trying to come together against each other's will. But where a person who is a Muslim, he will never try and force himself in a white restaurant or in some place owned and operated by the white man where he is not wanted. If we detect that the white man doesn't mind us entering, we enter. But when we detect that the white man does not want us, we think that it is exercising other than intelligence to try and force ourselves upon people or among people where we are not wanted. And I think you'll all agree, you're intelligent, that if you take a gun and hold it on a man and make him put his arm around me, that doesn't mean he loves me, and it doesn't mean we're practicing brotherhood. It's your gun that's making a hypocrite out of him. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad feel that when you try and pass integration laws here in America, forcing white people to pretend that they are accepting black people, what you are doing is making white people act in a hypocritical way. However, we feel that when you can change both of them and they come together voluntarily, without force or without pressure, then automatically you are furthering brotherhood and bringing about better relationship between the two races. And for this reason, we absolutely reject any form of integration, because as Thurgood Marshall himself admitted, 7 years have passed since the Supreme Court desegregation decision, and right now you only have 6% compliance with that law here in America. And if you can only get 6% compliance with the highest court in the land in 7 years, we who are Muslims, who represent this new so-called Negro who is impatient, think that it is too long to sit around here and wait for another 100 or 200 or 300 years just for a chance for equal education. So therefore, we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad absolutely reject integration, because we feel that it's hypocritical and that it takes too long. But as followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we feel that since the black man in America has been such a faithful servant to the white man during peacetime, and such a brave and faithful soldier during wartime, and helped defend America against its enemies abroad, help our free labor, help build this great economy and make it what it is, since we have discovered that it's impossible for the two of us to live together in peace, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad says it's best for us to separate. This doesn't mean we hate each other, but it means that's the only way that we're going to solve the problem. Since trying to come together solves the problem and makes you look bad, not us, in the sight of the entire world, we feel that separation is the solution. Not segregation, but separation. You say, what's the difference? And some have accused us of using semantics. They always hide behind some long word. Segregation is something that is done by a superior force to an inferior force. Segregation exists in America. You have segregated the black people. But separation is done by two equals. If you have a children and you are sustaining your children, providing them with food, clothing, and shelter, you exercise control over their lives. You segregate them in a sense. But when your son becomes 21, he wants to be his own boss. He wants to separate himself from you, go out and set up his own house, clothe himself, feed himself, and make jobs for himself. This way he feels independent. He doesn't feel like a boy anymore. And the followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad think that it's time for we as black people to do the same thing. Instead of staying here and being your boy and your gal and relying on you to give us jobs, relying on you to clothe us, and relying on you to look out for us and sustain us, which your economy today will not do. It just can sustain you, according to the latest reports from Secretary of Labor Goldberg. We feel that the best way to do is let us separate on some land right here, not with animosity, but with understanding. And since we claim to be your equal, then perhaps we can use the talent that you have allowed us to develop and the education that we have gotten in your institutions to farm and grow food for our people, set up factories and supply our people with the necessities, and in this way, by trying to do something for ourselves, we feel that it will solve the race problem and it will make the white people in America have more respect for black people whom they see trying to do something for themselves instead of standing outside their factory demanding your job or going down into your place of business demanding an opportunity to sit inside of it and things of that sort. We don't think that this is hate teaching. We don't think that this is advocating violence, but we do think that if you continue to try to solve the problem in a hypocritical way, which integration is, you're going to make the problem worse. The only way to do is to sit down and face the facts of the problem. Now, if integration will solve all of these defects, let's integrate. Secondly, if we can integrate tomorrow morning, let's integrate. But if we can't integrate 1,000% tomorrow morning, then the black people in America, the masses who don't think that they're doing anybody any favors by demanding that which you have by birth, who don't think that they should have to go all the way to the Supreme Court when you don't have to go to the Supreme Court, who don't think that they should have to wait for the Congress or Senate to legislate when you don't have to wait on the Congress or Senate to legislate, and who don't think that they should have to wait for the president to issue some proclamation, emancipation, when you don't have to wait for any president to say anything. Since we're all equal, we all have blood, we all have a head, arms, and legs, if we can't integrate in the morning and accept each other as human beings in the morning 1,000%, then there is not time left to re-educate the white man, to free him of his ingrained and inbred prejudices and feelings of white supremacy, to get him to accept the black people the same as he. I say that in all sincerity, not out of disrespect, and I hope that it has shed some light in corners that there wasn't any light. And I thank you for listening to me so attentively, and I hope you listen to my good friend here just as attentively. Thank you.
Nor will they necessarily rebut specific points in the other's statements. Mr. Allen will present a different viewpoint. Mr. Allen?
Thank you, Ms. Price. Mr. Moderator. Minister Malcolm X, ladies and gentlemen, by all standards, I should be dead. I feel a little bit like I did on the Saturday afternoon back about 1936 when we played Arkansas State. The first string fullback was knocked out, and they substituted me. For the first 30 minutes of the game, we had gotten a very rough time. We couldn't get anywhere. But for some unknown reason, the Keystone Express got hot. We made more ground in 20 minutes than the entire varsity backfield did all day. So you have to be careful of these substitutes. If I did not believe in equality, the dignity of man, or the brotherhood under the fatherhood of God, I would not now be engaged in the field of intergroup relations that I am. Accepting a challenge of this sort, I've had the opportunity of meeting a very wonderful group of people, similarly endowed with a spirit of charity, goodwill, and a determination to make this state and our nation a better place in which to live. As I look back upon my student days at Xavier University, I immediately think of the inscription deeply inscribed in the cornerstone of the administration building. Literal translation is, and I quote, "Man's greatest work on earth is man. Man's master art is leading man to God." During the past 20 years, this fact has taken on added significance. As a member of the NAACP, a member of the staff of the Urban League of Rhode Island, and more recently, a member of the Rhode Island Commission Against Discrimination, it has become eminently clear of the road that lies ahead. One road, and only one road, lies ahead. And that road is complete and full integration of the American Negro into all walks of our American society. I would be remiss in my duty if I didn't tell you that here in Rhode Island we do have some problems. Even at this very time, there is a very serious and continuous struggle and battle going on about fair housing. This is only one aspect of what we in Rhode Island have to contend with and have to fight with and for. But one thing is certain, as of now, the General Assembly has not convened. There is still time, and we are still hopeful that we will have a fair housing bill. Even in other areas of employment, public accommodation, education, and many other areas, there are still those isolated cases of prejudice and discrimination. And I, for one, can very well agree with some of the things that Minister Malcolm X said. But this is beside the point. A great deal of effort, more men and more women are engaged in the field of human relations today to rectify the situations that exist than any other time in our American history. One of the things that's important to note, and I think we have to go back and look at history itself. From the very first shot that was fired on Boston Commons at the beginning of the Revolutionary War, down to and including World War II, Battle of the Bulge, Bastion, and Normandy Beach. Every battlefield and every battleship flowed red with Negro blood. This was a contribution that the Negro made to American democracy. Every bit of the progress and development of this country, the Negro has made a substantial contribution toward that. And for this, we are rightfully and justly proud. But we don't hold any grudge about what has happened in the past. What we are concerned with is what is going to happen in the future. And anyone who looks back is lost. And we're not lost. Because what we are concerned with is what lies ahead. Today in the Southland, there is a great deal of controversy and trouble about integration, about school desegregation. Much is being done, much planning, much discussion. Certainly, it has taken a long, long time, much longer than anyone would want. But we do know that maybe it might take just a little bit longer. We have waited almost 100 years, and it's true, that's been a long time, and we're not content to wait another 100 years. But the only way this situation can be resolved is going to be done by the united efforts of every Negro and every white person. Each one has a challenge, and I can tell you what yours is. To many of you who are sitting here this evening, whether you realize it or not, within the next 15, the next 20 years, you are going to be the future leaders of your government in city, state, and national. What you do about the situation or what happens depends a great deal upon you. It depends a great deal on how you look and how you treat your fellow man. Whether or not you accept him as a human being and treat him with human dignity the same as you expect him to show you. Over the years, you have seen fit to set certain standards for the Negro that have been higher than anyone else. And the Negro has rose to the occasion on almost every instance. It was an unfortunate experience for such a young fellow, but thank God John Thomas proved that he was human when he didn't jump 7 feet 4 inches. He failed. He's human after all. If a Negro is a prize fighter, you expect him to recover quicker than anybody else, get up and knock the opponent out. If he's a sprinter, you expect him to run faster than anyone else. If he's a broad jumper, you expect him to jump farther than everyone else. If he's a student, you expect him to excel at everything academically. If he is a scientist, you expect him to be the greatest brain there is. Many of these things we have done, we have proven what we can do. How much more? What else is there that you want us to do? I think that we have proved these things. I think that we have shown that we are just as good a citizen as anyone else. And these are the things that you as individuals have got to take into account. I am reminded of an incident that happened back in 1943. And I say this because often I have been asked the question, is there a great deal of hate expressed toward the Negro from the white and from the white to the Negro? I say there is not. I say whatever hate there is developed primarily on isolated or individual cases. But back in 1943, during the course of the early years of the war, I happened to have been stationed at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. I was a supply sergeant and did have a few privileges that others didn't have. I had one lieutenant who was a Texan, and as you know, Texans are always big fellows. They do things in a big way when they do it. So this particular day, the lieutenant was officer of the day. We decided that we would have dinner in the supply room that evening. So I sent the Jeep over for dinner at the service club, and he brought back all of the trimmings, including the tablecloth. And as we sat in the back room, a bottle of cognac on the table, the company commander walked in, full colonel. No orderly in the office, and no officer of the day. And he came back into the supply room and he saw us and we jumped to attention. And he looked at the lieutenant and he said, "Don't you know that there is a rule against officers fraternizing with enlisted personnel?" The lieutenant looked at him and said, "Sir, the day that I can't have a drink or exchange a bit of fellowship with a gentleman and a soldier, that's the day you can have these bars." And the colonel looked at him for a minute, retreated 2 paces, saluted, and said, "Gentlemen, carry on." I say that to say this, that there are many people who have no hatred, do not despise one another, and treat and accept each individual as a human being, as a gentleman, and as a person. We are concerned naturally with what happens about the progress, the development, and the welfare of the individual. In our state, we have a law which is passed by General Assembly in 1949. It is administered by the Commission Against Discrimination. That assures each and every person equal employment opportunities, equal opportunities in public accommodation, equal educational facilities, and etc. When this, or prior to the enactment of this law in 1949, conditions were not so good. But since 1949, and in the last few years, all one has to do is to walk the streets of the city of Providence, go into most of the stores, go into any bank, and you find that Negroes are fully integrated within the workforce of those particular establishments. This is a tribute to the Urban League, to the Commission Against Discrimination, to the NAACP, and to those men and women who worked very hard to bring this thing about. It proves and it shows again that people can work together, and by the same token, people can live together if given the opportunity and the chance. We in Rhode Island are proud of the accomplishments we have made, and I think that we are justly proud of the accomplishments that will be made across the country. And so it's not an easy matter to think that all that has happened has not been done so without some sacrifice and some difficulty. But whatever the price, whatever sacrifice is necessary to achieve and to accomplish full integration and to become acceptable in a democratic society as a first-class citizen, the Negro has made his contribution. I am sure that he is willing to make additional sacrifices. I do not need 50 minutes to tell you these things. Most of them, or many of them, you know. But I would leave you with this one thought. The next time you stand to sing the Star Spangled Banner, remember that it takes all 88 keys, black and white, to play it. Thank you.
I'm sure that I speak for the university. I know I do not speak for the Brown Daily Herald in saying that we are grateful to Minister Malcolm X, to Mr. Ralph Allen for their, each in its own way, very, I thought, compelling and eloquent statements about a very sober and a very serious question which confronts all of us today. I have not spent an evening, I don't know about the rest of you, I have not spent a full evening with my son for some time, and I promised him that I would be home about 10 o'clock, so I'm going to exercise a certain arbitrariness in the part of, which is the province, I think, of any moderator, and try and make certain that this meeting does end by 10, which gives us a good half hour. I dare say there are many questions which members of the audience have. I believe there are gentlemen in the aisles who have mobile microphones and hopefully will ensure that the questioner will be heard by all in the hall, and both Minister Malcolm X and Mr. Allen, as I say, have agreed to answer whatever questions you may have. I hope, by the way, that the questions will be relatively briefly put and that they will themselves not be speeches. This may be, again, a semantic, a question of semantics, but I think I'll rule on that. I would also hope, so as to give as many of those of you who do have questions an opportunity to ask him, both Minister Malcolm and Mr. Allen will themselves be at least semi-brief in answering the questions. May we begin then? Yes, ma'am.
This question is addressed to Malcolm X. You stated at the beginning of your speech that when the white man views his savior, he has called him such things as his leader and his God. And you also maintain that your savior is known as Allah. Now, my question is whether these two gods are one and the same person, or are they separate gods with two completely opposing doctrines that cannot be reconciled?
We look upon Allah as the creator of the universe, the God, the creator of the universe, the supreme being. When you say, whatever you call your God, if you regard him as the creator of the universe, then we're talking about the same God.
And these two doctrines are not opposed then?
We who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who are Muslims, believe in the Holy Quran, and the Holy Quran recognizes Jesus and Moses and all of the prophets. But the Holy Quran refers to Jesus as Isa ibn Maryam, Jesus son of Mary, and they recognize that which he taught as Islam, and that which Moses taught as Islam.
My question is addressed to Mr. Malcolm X. In Eric Rankin's book, The Black Muslims in America, he quotes you as making the following statement. In America, the Jews sap the very lifeblood of the so-called Negroes to maintain the State of Israel, its armies, and its continued aggression against our brothers in the East. Is the Jews sap the very lifeblood of the so-called Negroes. I wonder if you would comment on this and on anti-Semitism in general in the black Muslim movement.
There's no anti-Semitism in Islam, because the Arabs and by and large the greater portion of people in the Muslim world are Semites, so-called Semites. And as regards to that statement that he quoted me as saying, on page 18 he also quotes me as having had a two-hour secret conference with Castro, for which we are suing the New York Journal American for $3 million for wrongly reporting. And if that's indicative of Dr. Lincoln's research, then it also sheds light on the nature of the rest of the statements in there that he made or that he put in our mouth. We're not anti-Semitic. We're anti-oppression, anti-lynching, and anti-exploitation.
Yes, back there.
My question is for Mr. Allen. Sir, Malcolm X describes the Negro in America as someone, a person maybe deserving of some of the things he says he has received of when he describes these different so-called political and social diseases. Recognizing those statistics that the Negro does contribute more of his share to some of the social ills that we suffer today. What is your cure for this? What is your way of fighting the situation as opposed to separation of the races?
Well, first, we do not believe in the separation of the races. As I said, we believe in integration. I think that first, one of the first cures to this particular problem will be the opportunity for every Negro or any Negro who has the economic means to live in decent, safe, and sanitary housing in areas of his or her choice. I think that is one of the first steps that has to be obtained. Secondly, I think the matter of full employment, that is, integration in employment based on skill, qualification, and ability, is the other answer. And last but not least, we cannot rule out education and parental motivation. I think all of these are important factors to be considered.
Yes,
sir.
Mr. Schultz. Oh, I'm sorry.
Please. I would like to comment on that, that we feel, as in answer to your question to him, we feel that the so-called Negro in America is already separated. We're not advocating separation. He's already separated. The Negro community and the white community is already separated. They're separated economically. You have a classification for Negroes to work in and a classification where they can't work. You have areas where they can't live, areas where they can't live. Schools that they can't go to, schools that they can go to. So we're not advocating something new. We only advocate that America practice what it preaches or preach what it practices.
My question is for Mr. Malcolm X also. We all realize that it's difficult to live in a vacuum. We are not insulated. And these are indeed difficult internal problems. In the light of the world situation, are Muslims also Americans?
If I answer you like this.
If
you're sitting at a table eating food or dining, because I come and sit near the table doesn't make me a diner. Yeah, I have to be enjoying the same thing that you're enjoying as a diner before I can refer to myself as a diner. Likewise, with American, with being an American. The only way I can intelligently call myself an American is if I get everything that is due in America. If the Constitution makes me an American, then the Constitution needs no changes, no amendments, no anything. It included me in the beginning, and it includes me now. But if you have to change it to include me, then that means the original document left me out, and I'd look unintelligent trying to include myself in something that excluded me from the start. Thank you.
Question directed at Mr. X. We are called Negroes. Isn't the thing that we are most concerned with is to be called human beings? How is it possible for us to find acceptance as human beings on isolated land somewhere alone? Is this not segregation of yourself?
As soon as you're called a Negro, you're automatically dehumanized. If you notice, sir, black people can come to this country and who are not called Negroes and are given respect. They can come here from Africa, India, or anywhere. But the white man has taught you and me that Negro means black in Spanish. We're not Spanish-speaking people. If you call the average so-called Negro a black person, he gets indignant. He'll say, don't call me black, call me a Negro. What does Negro mean? He'll say, it means black in Spanish. Doesn't even make sense. So we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we reject the term Negro, and we don't think that we're isolating ourselves going off alone, because when it comes to employment, we're already alone. When it comes to housing, we're already alone. When it comes to citizenship, first class, we're already alone. We're not asking for any classification of anything that doesn't already exist.
I couldn't let this go by. We are all American Negroes, whether we like it or not, whether we want to change the name or not. We are still 100% American Negroes and citizens of these United States.
I have two questions here. I'd like to direct one to Mr. X and the one to Ms. Allen. I'd like to direct this one to Mr. X first. I'd like to ask you that you said that you advocated the separation of the races and that you feel that through this, the Negro can advance to the position you stated that he should have. Now, I'd like to ask, how do you propose doing this? How do your leader, your teachings, how do you propose to lead the Negro out of the so-called turmoil that he's in? I don't recall all the statements that you made in your speech, but I'd like to ask in essence that how does the teaching of Islam, what does it hold for the Negro? How can you
What do you propose is? Where is your salvation that you're offering?
Which one of these questions do you want me to ask?
Well, they're all related. Well, I'd like to ask you first, that's how do you propose is to lead the so-called Negro of America to the promised land? I mean, how is a separate state going to advance his status here in America?
The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that when you turn the black man in America into the religion of Islam, you're not turning him into something new. You're turning him back to that culture in which he was found when he was kidnapped and brought here. And an article in the Look magazine on Africa about 3 weeks ago emphasized that the culture and religion of the black man prior to being brought here was the religion of Islam. And in order to make him have the inferiority complex that's necessary to create a good slave, all of his knowledge concerning his past was taken away, so that today he lives in and from an inferiority complex. And this makes him feel that he can't do without the white man. And the reaction or result of that, he finds himself forcing himself into places and into areas and upon people where he is not wanted. So Islam, by turning him back toward his original culture, giving him a knowledge of his original self and the contributions that our people made, it has a tendency to eliminate this inferiority complex that has been bred into him. And when that is done, he begins then to be able to stand on his own feet and try and do something for himself.
You say that the Negro, you connect the Negro of America and the religion of Islam so closely. In my opinion, the present American Negro is totally divorced from its origin, of course.
But why? What divorced him from it?
What do you say?
What divorced him from his origin?
Well, we are all aware of the fact that how we originated.
You can't deal with the condition until you recognize the cause.
We know the cause, why we're here.
You can't integrate with the cause of a man's condition.
Oh, I don't mean to debate you. I'd like to direct this question to Mr. Allen now, if I may.
From now on, we'll limit them to one, but since you possess the mic, you may ask the other one.
I'd like to ask Mr. Allen, in his opinion, what causes Negroes to fall prey to cults and all kinds of get-rich-by-night schemes and things of this nature? What, in your opinion, lead us to become victims of exploitation of various groups promising the promised land and to lead us out of our so-called damnation? In your opinion, what lead us to follow these people?
Well, the only answer that I could give you is one, it's a sense of wanting to belong to something. Secondly, I think it's a matter of feeling of insecurity. I think that's the only answer that I can give you for it.
Sir, you got another little comment coming. Instead of asking what makes black people fall victim to cults and get-rich-quick schemes, it would have been more intelligent to ask what caused the black people to be enslaved, what caused the black people to be lynched, what caused black people to be second-class citizens, and what caused black people to stand up and defend white people when they can't defend themselves?
I fear that I've been unfair to people in the back of the room. Yes, sir. Yes.
I'd like to direct a question to Mr. X. First of all, I'd like to start off by saying that as an American Negro, I am proud to be an American Negro, and also I deplore being put in the category of a reefer smoker, a jailbird, etc. I would like to state also that I take baths more frequently than every Saturday night. And I have a great many friends, both Negro and white, who act the same way. Now what, sir, can you or Elijah Muhammad do for the American, not so-called Negro, but the American Negro, who already have reached the heights to which you are trying to get the group?
Can't do anything for you.
Thank you.
That you advocate total separation. How can you reconcile that with the fact that you're asking for only partial separation when you want some bounty from the white man, such as a little land right here? Is it because you feel that you live better in the United States, as we all do, of course, we're both white and black? But separation is separation. Now, if you want total or partial separation, go home and have it.
Which question do you want answered? Yes. You have to look at it as it existed prior to the Emancipation Proclamation. Before the Emancipation Proclamation, you had two kinds of Negroes, the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro lived with his master. He loved his master. When his master said, we are full, he said, we are full. When his master said, our house is beautiful, the house Negro said, yes, our house is beautiful. If the master said, our house is on fire, the house Negro said, yes, our house is on fire, and he tried harder to put the fire out than the master did himself. The difference between the house Negro and the field Negro, when the master's house was on fire, whenever the master said, our or we, the field Negro never said, our or we. He said, he or they. He never identified himself with his master, and when the master's was sick, he didn't say, we are sick. He said, he is sick. When his master's house was on fire, he didn't say, our house is on fire. He said, his house is on fire. Instead of as the house Negro was trying to keep the house from burning down, the field Negro was praying that the master's house burn down.
Way in the back there. Yes. Yes.
Sir, number one, I would like to point out, and it's one of the reasons why the controversy exists probably between us and the NAACP. They advocate integration, we advocate separation. And we state that the NAACP represents the middle class or upper class Negro who does not want to separate but wants to integrate. And we represent the masses of black people, the oppressed, the downtrodden, the majority, who do want to separate, primarily because it is they who are under the brunt of the full pressure. And it's not hard to separate someone from a condition that's making him suffer. But that one, as brother there pointed out, I guess he's my brother, that one who thinks that his suffering has already been alleviated or rectified or corrected, and has no feeling for the masses of his people who are yet suffering, he's the only one that you can't get to separate. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad has stated, and he told this to the press conference in Los Angeles 3 weeks ago, that when the United States government itself, instead of the press, asked him the machinery that he has in mind that is necessary to bring about this separation, the amount of states that it will take, and the number of people that he feels will go with him, he will disclose that to the United States government. Up until this point, I have yet to hear him say how many states or how it will be done, but I can tell you this from traveling, that I think any NAACP national spokesman will admit that the masses of black people here in America will separate faster than the white man will bring about integration.
The NAACP is concerned with all Negroes. the low, the middle, and the upper strata. They are also concerned with the welfare of the masses in all areas, not in any particular area, high or low.
Yes, back there.
Malcolm X, I would like to know, as a purely practical consideration, how would it be possible to establish within the United States a separate economic system with the Negroes in control, a separate road system, as you stated, a separate factory system? In other words, how is this possible?
They have a, sir, you have a separate economic system now, but it's controlled by the white man. You have a separate housing condition, system, educational system, and a political system. The very fact that you got second-class citizens and first-class citizens shows you that all races are separate politically. And the very fact that Negroes are the last hired in the first five shows that they're separate economically. And the very fact that so-called Negroes are ostracized from society shows that they're already separate socially. Now. So we don't have to bring about any separation. It already exists. All we are trying to do is make sense.
Format would you have? Would you have a president, or would it be a religious organization? How would you set yourself up?
When a wolf has captured a sheep and is mutilating that sheep, and then the shepherd comes after the sheep is not going to ask, what type of condition are you taking me into? The only one who has time to answer ask that type of question is the wolf, who is the oppressor, and who is more concerned with the systems and things that will exist than that victim is concerned with the alleviation.
Sir, but I would also like to say that when the Jews. Egypt by Moses, yes, this existed, but at that time there were not atomic powers in the world today. The world did not have two conflicts, say Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Khrushchev, as it is. In an article in the U.S. News and World Report, it was stated that your ally would like to have a state. I merely ask you what you are going to give to people. Let's not be evasive. I mean, answer me.
I'll answer you straight. Wait a minute. Yes, when you say my Allah, it's my Allah that will strike your country with plagues of floods and snow and tornadoes and drop your airplanes out of the sky. It's my Allah that will bring you to your knees, not I. I believe in nonviolence, but it's the same as Moses. God struck Pharaoh with plagues. Today there's a modern Moses in the land, and if you think that God would strike that slave master 4,000 years ago for the injustices that he committed against those people, and you think that a God today will let America get by with the 400 years of enslavement and lynching and exploitation of the black people here in this country, sir, then you're playing God's intelligence cheap. It's not a case, sir, of God siding with one person. He sided with Pharaoh, with Moses against Pharaoh. He sided with Daniel against Nebuchadnezzar. If you read your Bible, whether you're a Jew or a Christian, you'll have to admit God always took his side, his stand on the side of the slave against the slave master. And I don't say this disrespectfully, but I'm not the criminal. It was not my people who came here voluntarily. We were brought here in chains as slaves. It is not I who is responsible for the race problem today. It is your forefathers who made slaves out of our people, deprived us of our rights, and dehumanized us, and today you should be apologizing for it instead of starting an argument.
I'd like to address my question to Mr. Allen, please. What
NEP and similar organizations intend to do about the black Muslims? What kind of tactics are they going to employ to... It is obvious that it's a very militant organization with rather extreme views and must be met in some way, and some tactics will have to be evolved to make them harmless. What does the NWCP intend to do?
I wish I could answer that question for you, but I haven't the answer right now.
Can I comment on this question?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to take up all the time, but one of the maneuvers or methods that the NAACP has devised to offset us is the failure tonight of one of their national representatives to be here. One of their tactics is to attack us on a... I don't say this in condemnation of Brother Allen here, but one of their tactics on a national scale is to attack us nationally. The national representatives of it attacked us nationally. The press picks up their statements and carries it across the country, but when it comes time for one of them to meet us on a platform, they never do so. We have a standing challenge to any national member of the NAACP, Wilkins, Marshall, or any of them who have been attacking us, to discuss any controversy face-to-face, and they have yet to pick up that challenge, because I don't think they can.
I will make this observation. The challenge is forthcoming in a very immediate future.
In reference to this, since the meeting began, we got a statement from Mr. Wright from New York City, of which I'd like to read part of it. For the record, lest my declination be misunderstood, I have debated Malcolm X on several occasions in the past at various colleges and universities. Certainly, Mr. X will not soon forget our debate at the Yale University Law School. The objective of our recent national policy is to prevent fly-by-night organizations from using the prestige and goodwill developed by the association and its members over the years through arduous work and much sacrifice from being misused. In previous debates, from press reports and past personal experience, such organizations have not dealt with the basic issues of strategy and procedure for directing the future fight for the removal of segregation and discrimination in the United States, but rather emotional appeal and tirades designed to enhance their standing with those persons whose miserable conditions they would seek to exploit. It is my sincere hope that as a result of tonight's discussion, the Brown University student body will become more aware of the important role which they can and must play in order to hasten the demise of Jim Crow. Able young Negroes throughout the nation are no longer content to stand by and have their rights violated. It is imperative, therefore, as a matter of moral and ethical justice, as well as constitutional right, that the fight to remove racial bias be accelerated to the end that all Americans can soon enjoy the privileges and bounties of our great country. I trust that I shall be privileged to speak to you in person at some convenient date in the near future. Herbert L. Wright, Director, Youth and College Division, NAACP.
Where I was very happy to hear Mr. Herbert Wright's message sent in absentia. Is that the word, Professor? if we are a fly-by-night organization, then much of the time and energy that has been spent here in America in discussing the Muslims or the Muslim movement has been spent in vain and to no avail. At the debate at Harvard College or University, the attorney Carrington pointed out that the membership of the NAACP was approximately 200,000, at which time he accused us of having only 100,000. Well, we've never given our figures. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad keeps those between himself and Allah. But he did tell the press that he's getting 1,000 converts a day, and I haven't seen him for 3 weeks, so I don't know how many he has now. But I want to point out this, that since the NAACP claims to have 200,000 in its membership, and they accuse us of only having 100,000, since their membership is integrated, which means part of that 200,000 is white, so it can't be a black voice, but probably it's a gray voice, We will say that the voice that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is speaking with is a black voice, because nobody is following him but members of the black people here in this country. And I would like to point out right here and now that I have not ever attacked the NAACP. Any charge that we have done so is false. The only time we have ever mentioned them is in reaction to statements that they've made against us. We have made this charge that the NAACP has been in existence here in America for 51 years. They elect the president every year, which means they've had a presidential election 51 times, and not one of those 51 elections have they elected a black man as president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So we do say this, that since Spingarn, a white man, has been president for the past 21 years, and he has been elected every year, which means he's been elected 21 times, if an organization like the NAACP can't find any black people in it who are qualified to hold that office as president, either they are practicing some form of prejudice, or they are not preparing the so-called Negroes who are in that organization for leadership capacity, and we do criticize that. Thank you.
My question is directed to Mr. Malcolm X, or perhaps it's more of a statement. Mr. X, I would suggest that you and your leader had better hasten to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights at the UN. A commission, I might add, that does not speak with a white voice, but with an Asiatic, an African, and a white voice. They have three times since their inception condemned your brother Muslims in Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries for raiding Negro or African tribes in Africa and selling them into slavery.
Sir, if I was Jesse... If I was Jesse James and was caught robbing a bank, I'd be reluctant to look at a little boy who's holding somebody up with a cap pistol. And when it comes to slavery, there is no country on earth that has practiced slavery more thoroughly than this country right here that calls itself the United States of America. And I don't think that as an anti-American statement, because our brothers have worked harder and made more sacrifices here than many white people have. But what I'm trying to show the white people in this audience and across the country, that you should realize that the black people in this country, more people like I do than you realize, more feel like I do than you realize, and they're the ones that are the most dangerous to you because they are the ones who will take action. These moderate, upper class Negroes are satisfied with the status quo, and they are satisfied for the white man to make up his mind the degree of recognition and citizenship that they're going to get. But the masses of black people are not satisfied. They don't care what's going on in Russia. They don't care what's going on in South Africa. And they don't care what's going on in China or Arabia or Pakistan. What they're interested in is something immediately being done to stop the oppression and the exploitation and the shameful and disgraceful condition that our people have to live in here under this system that you call democracy and freedom and justice. And you should be thankful that I tell you that.
Way in the back there. Sir, I respect your ideals. I respect your...
So who is the question addressed, please?
Malcolm X. I'm sorry. I respect your aims to eliminate oppression, to eliminate persecution and exploitation and so forth. And on these grounds, it's hard to argue with you. But yet, don't you feel that your way to eliminate these things is a great tarnishing of an ideal? Don't you believe that the very fabric of our civilization is towards union? Don't we have a United Nations now? Didn't we have a League of Nations which was less unified? I mean, aren't things progressing towards better understanding? Isn't a separation a positive corruption of better relations? It's just the wrong approach.
Which question shall I answer, Professor? Sir, I think you must realize that an oppressor
usually measures progress with a different yardstick than that that is used by the oppressed. If a man is sitting on a hot stove and you're holding him there, you may think you're letting him up fast, but you ask him how fast he's getting up. And I think that this is the mistake that the American white man is making. He is trying to get the black people of America to measure the rate of progress they're making by using his yardstick. And another mistake that you're making is a similar mistake, if you'll allow me, that was made by misjudging the Cuban situation, simply by taking the information from the wrong persons, the upper-class Cubans. And you therefore thought that the masses down there would rise up and take side with you. This was wrong information by relying on the wrong person. Here in America, the average white man, in trying to find out the thinking and the feelings of the black masses, in my opinion, asked the wrong so-called Negro. Usually the Negro that you ask is the upper class or middle class Negro to whom the stove is not hot, but is only warm. And when a man is sitting on a warm stove, naturally he can take a longer time getting up than the man that's sitting on the hot stove. The masses of black people in America are on a hot stove. The upper class Negroes are on a warm stove.
Sir, you may be on a hot stove, but when you're separated entirely, which is your ideal, you're going to be on a hotter stove.
I don't know how you mean.
Well, by being separated completely.
Sir, now in a country that is the almost the father of separation and segregation and supremacy and racism, I'm surprised to come to a college or a university and find students who will react to our request for separation in this way. Why, separation and segregation, white supremacy and racism have been practiced, perfected to a higher degree here in America by white people against black people than it has anywhere since the beginning of time, because these so-called Negroes have been so thoroughly brainwashed by the white supremacy system that today when it's practiced against them, they don't even realize it. Do you realize there are black people here who put lye on their hair to straighten it because they hate the texture of their own hair, who hate their features, who hate the color of their skin? This is the result of white supremacy teaching. And but it's so crudely done, they don't even realize they hate themselves or that they hate their history or their own culture. And this type of hate has been perpetuated by the white man. And I don't think that you're in a position to accuse us of hate teaching or violence or anything like that, because if we teach it, then you were our teachers and you were a good teacher.
I don't want to cut off discussion and questions. Mr. Malcolm and Mr. Allen have both agreed, for those who are interested and want to discuss things on a more intimate basis, that they would be glad to have you come up afterwards and do so. It is 10 o'clock, however, and as is their wonted custom, the Brown Daily Herald insists upon having the last word. You have my permission to leave, but I suppose you might want to listen to Mr. Holbrook. Just one more, Mr. Holbrook.
And right about, I won't have anything to say, except that I'd like to thank Minister Malcolm, Mr. Allen, and I was going to thank Dean Schultz, but I won't, for attending this meeting tonight. Good night.